Education Committee for the March 6th, 2017. We've got a very interesting and fun schedule today because we're going to start with an informational hearing. And so the first thing we're going to do is open up an informational hearing on the Special Olympics. And it is with a lot of pride that I bring up former Governor Barbara Roberts, Carrie Timchuk of the Oregon Historical Society, and Margie Hunt, the Executive Director of Special Olympics. Welcome.
Thank you. I have to be on the left. It's required. It's a joke.
Thank you very much. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. We are if you are. Okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Governor Barbara Roberts, and I am an enthusiastic member of the Board of Directors of Special Olympics Oregon. We are very grateful for this opportunity to speak to the House Education Committee today about Special Olympics Oregon, an organization that profoundly impacts children and youth, both with and without disabilities, in Oregon schools. Let me first thank you for your public service. Legislative service is not easy. I've been in your shoes, and I have not forgotten. Budget challenges and competing interests for short dollars are a constant pressure. So thank you for good people who serve in government, and I appreciate your stepping forward and doing that for the citizens of Oregon. Now, I do not come to Salem to testify in a committee meeting very often. I would not be here if it were a minor matter. I'm here today because I know the critical importance of the issues we will be discussing. I know what it means to the quality of life for tens of thousands of children and youth in Oregon schools, and I know what it means to our entire education system. In the next few minutes, you will hear about one of the best kept secrets in this state, the work of Special Olympics Oregon. You know the brand, everyone does, but today you will learn why this organization is one of the most significant partners this state has, and how Special Olympics is helping Oregon meet major government directives and mandates. The fact is, Special Olympics Oregon has stepped up for several years and assumed a leadership role in response to these government mandates. Now, we're here to ask for your help. We'd like to begin by providing some important general background for you today, and I'm going to turn it over to Carrie for that.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carrie Timchuk, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Historical Society. And before I continue on with the message in that regard, this coming Saturday, as you know, is the special legislative tour of our 100,000-square-foot warehouse in Gresham. I know, Representative Doherty, you have gone, and Representative Parrish, you have been. I would encourage all legislators to attend because I'm sure you agree it's phenomenal. So
it is phenomenal. Go if you can.
So, but more importantly here today, in addition, I have just completed 4 terms as board chair of Special Olympics Oregon, and I'm continuing as an active member of the board of directors along with Governor Roberts. And I join with the governor in thanking you for your public service and support you in creating a better Oregon for all. That takes teamwork, collaboration, and partnerships, and that's how we come to you today as partners. Let me provide some general background for you on Special Olympics Oregon, because there are some misconceptions. One, Special Olympics Oregon serves the largest disability population in the state. Let me repeat, we serve the largest disability population in the state, individuals with intellectual disabilities, medically referred to as mental retardation. This is also the largest disability population in any state and includes a wide range of causes and degrees of disability, ranging from Down syndrome to significant autism. Many of our participants also have a physical disability. Currently, Special Olympics Oregon has over 14,000 participants statewide of all ages, with an estimated 100,000 or more who could benefit from our programs. Over the last 10 years, we have seen a phenomenal 983% growth. 983% growth in our participation level. We offer programs statewide and year-round. Our games are always, has been our motto. Every day, every week, every month, every year, there is a Special Olympics program going on somewhere in Oregon. And importantly, our programs are offered at no cost to participants. On any given day, except major holidays, Special Olympics activities are going on in Oregon. More than 1 in 8 Oregon students receive special education services in the state schools, a fact very familiar to those of you who are educators or members here of the committee. And we have a very successful partnership with hundreds of Oregon schools, which we'll tell you more about. In fact, more than 2/3 of participants join Special Olympics Oregon through a school-based program. To serve our mission, we rely on thousands of volunteers all over the state, nearly 7,000 every year. We do not pay them, not because they don't deserve it, they do, but we don't pay them because they are priceless. Without them, we simply could not do what we do. In 30 Oregon counties, we provide our services through trained volunteer leadership teams, amazing Oregonians who give of their time, talent, and heart to serve our constituency year-round. We have a major partnership with hundreds of Oregon schools. This is so inspiring, our Unified Champion Schools Initiative. This includes unified sports, where students with and without disabilities are participants on the same team and in health and wellness programs. It also includes our Respect campaign, which is creating a culture of respect in many Oregon schools. These programs are all funded by Special Olympics Oregon. We have a longstanding partnership, as Representative Evans knows, with Oregon's law enforcement community under the banner Law Enforcement Torch Run. These officers serve as a key volunteer partner to Special Olympics Oregon activities statewide. We partner with the families of our participants through an organized family network, providing an ongoing source for the sharing of information, support, and counsel family to family. And now we have partnered with Oregon State University through our Oregon Team Wellness Initiative, which provides a unique curriculum in health and fitness developed by Special Olympics Oregon that teaches our constituency how to take care of themselves in their daily lives. It essentially makes being healthy and being well a competition, and you can get a medal for it. This program has garnered national attention and has now been launched by 4 other states. Special Olympics Oregon is currently funded through the private sector, specifically foundations, corporate sponsors, and individual donors. Our annual budget is approximately $8.8 million, with additional in-kind support that is also very significant. We partner in every way with many of Oregon's business and community leaders in raising the critical dollars to bring our programs to the thousands with intellectual disabilities whose lives are changed and made better because of Special Olympics. Our impact is deep, wide, diverse, and measurable. And here to talk to us more about our impact is our Executive Director, Margie Hunt.
Thank you. Excuse me. Chair Doherty. And members of the committee, my name is Margie Hunt, and I am the CEO of Special Olympics Oregon, and it's a real privilege. It is also the privilege, I also have the privilege of sharing some information about the impact of Special Olympics Oregon with you. There's solid empirical evidence on the overarching impact. So Special Olympics, as you might guess, has a powerful impact on the wider community by changing public attitudes towards people with intellectual disabilities. So if you're a high school student on a team with someone who has intellectual disabilities, you are changed and our athletes are changed. It's an incredible experience. For example, studies have shown that support for inclusion of students with intellectual disabilities in regular classrooms increased from 2 to 55%. I'm sorry, support for inclusion of students with intellectual disabilities in regular classrooms increased from 2% to 55% as people became more involved with Special Olympics. Special Olympics also leads to greater opportunities for employment for those with intellectual disabilities, and I would suggest to you that it's a major untapped labor force. 52% of adult Special Olympics participants in the United States are employed. For adult individuals in the general population with intellectual disabilities who are not in Special Olympics, the percentage is just 34% or lower. And in the broadest sense, Special Olympics Oregon is impacting the very economy of our communities. Our programs focus on the development of what we call tools for life, which lead to the following personal improvements with our folks. Increased social and communication skills, 90% of participant family members report improvement in relationship skills and friendships, increased self-esteem and confidence. Of course, our folks just want to be like everybody else, and that really they gained confidence by what they are doing in Special Olympics. Increased motor skills, improved cognitive skills, improved physical fitness, increased training in healthcare. And so when you take the largest disability population in a community and that is able to progress in these areas, they develop, again, increased, our constituency develops increased independence and are statistically more likely to hold a job and or live alone. So as we perform our mission well, we impact the very economy of our communities. And this is one key reason why other state legislators support their Special Olympics state chapters. In fact, over half the other states in the country. There are thousands of individual examples of the impact of Special Olympics life-changing programs on those we serve. So let me just share a few that, and again, we could spend hours just talking about wonderful stories. Let me tell you, there's a boy named Eric with intellectual disabilities. He had lots of buddies in high school because he was just tall, good-looking guy, definitely one of ours, but he lost all of those friends at graduation because they went on to jobs and they went on to college and they went on to marriage, and he did not and could not. And then he got involved with Special Olympics and said he had found his forever friends. Mm-hmm. There's a boy with severe autism who had never hugged either of his parents, which is not uncommon in autism. Then one day, in a Special Olympics event, the gun went off. He took off running. His father was at the other end of the race. He ran right into his father's arms. It was the first time. Excuse me, I was there. It was the first time he had ever hugged his dad. There's Amelia with intellectual disabilities who used to be terribly bullied in her school, and our constituency can be bullied, until the school launched our respect campaign. And today, Amelia is not only feeling very good about herself, she's a spokesperson for the cause, a leader in Special Olympics respect campaign. Then there's Jimmy, who has intellectual disabilities as well as cerebral palsy, which is not uncommon that there's physical disability as well. And he tried every year to complete the cross-country course in our state winter games on the top of Mount Bachelor, falling, getting up. And in Special Olympics, you earn your medals. You can't just jump on. Mom and Dad can't jump on and help. Until finally, one year, he made it through the whole course. Jimmy grinned. His mother cried, and the whole mountain cheered. There's Janice, a volunteer Special Olympics coach, who doesn't even have a child in the program, but who actively helps build and mold the lives of the Special Olympics participants she trains so that they can develop confidence, belief, and belief in themselves. She is one of over thousands of certified Special Olympics Oregon coaches. There's Marie, the elderly woman on a fixed income who worries for our organization if she can't make her $25 contribution that month. She's an inspiration and a constant reminder of the huge fiduciary responsibility we have to our donors, no matter how small or large. In every Special Olympics story, there is a common thread, the revealing of the champion in all of us. Whether you have intellectual disability or you're a volunteer or you're a coach or you're like me, I just get to hang out with our folks sometimes and give high fives. The Special Olympics participant knows that he or she is different, and yet we are so the same. They know what it means to be loved or not. They can set goals and achieve them. They can learn, compete, run the distance, be responsible, hold a job, have a vision, be leaders, and do great things. And in the process, they reveal the champion in all the rest of us. They make us better. They make us dig deep, find the courage and strength to reach higher and do more than we ever thought we could. Chair Doherty and committee members, there is a powerful spirit in this work. You can't measure it, but you feel it. It's just there. And if you are a fan of dignity, acceptance, and the human race, you were already a fan of Special Olympics Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. If I might now do some closing remarks for the committee, I appreciate your patience, and we hope we have time for a few questions, so let me continue. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Carrie and Margie have given you an overview of the tremendous impact of Special Olympics Oregon on the children and youth in our state, both in our schools and in our community programs. As you've heard, the bedrock of this organization is partnerships. Let me tell you why the state's partnership with Special Olympics is of the greatest importance at this time. There are three issues where schools across the country, including in Oregon, are experiencing great pressure from state and federal government, and they intend us to be able to solve these three issues. There's also citizen pressure on these same three issues. The first issue is bullying. Bullying in our schools, which threatens students' physical and emotional safety, negatively impacts the ability to learn, can lead to dropouts, and in extreme instances, even to suicide. Leading the solution is a statewide respect campaign introduced and managed by Special Olympics Oregon in partnership with youth leadership in over 200 Oregon schools, and it is growing. Students serve as leaders, conducting assemblies, writing and publishing respect articles, presenting respect videos, actively using social media in general, and promoting respect and inclusion in their schools. This highly successful campaign is conducted in collaboration with the Oregon Association of Student Councils, as well as OSAA, and has been endorsed by the National Association of State Boards of Education, and I know a number of you have that school board experience. The best way to address bullying is to stop it before it starts, and Special Olympics Oregon is on the front lines of this fight, and we are beginning to win. The second issue is inequality in extracurricular opportunities for those with disabilities. As a result of recently reported findings by the federal government, schools are now required to solve this issue. Again, Special Olympics is a key partner to the state through its program of unified sports in Oregon schools, and students with and without disabilities are provided additional extracurricular sports opportunities year-round. The Unified Sports Program also fosters inclusion and greater understanding of all who have disabilities by those who do not. As with the Respect Campaign, Special Olympic Oregon's Unified Sports Program is offered in collaboration with the Oregon School Activities Association, as well as other major education-related organizations in the state. The third issue, the obesity epidemic among school-aged children. The health and wellness of our children and youth continues to be a major challenge. Schools are required to implement policies and practices in the education environment to help curb this problem. And again, the state's partner, Special Olympics Oregon, is helping to meet this challenge. Under the banner, Wellness is a Sport, and in collaboration with the head of OHSU's Wellness Center and other health and fitness professionals, we at Special Olympics developed a program which has been copyrighted, and it is a year-round nutrition and fitness curriculum for individuals with intellectual disabilities, but it's also a unified program. I'm going to hold up so you can see this is not some small program. This is the coach's manual, and this is the program. So this is really a very big deal in terms of wellness and weight control and other things that lead to health. The thing that's important is our team wellness program has been endorsed by the American Association of Health and Disability and is being instituted by Special Olympics state chapters now in the state of Washington, in Montana, in Southern California, and in Illinois. Oregon has been the blueprint, the national blueprint for this program where I just held that up. We've copyrighted it and we are now sharing it with states all over the United States. In 2016, we began the program here in Oregon schools, and we continue it in 2017 and on. So Chair Doherty and committee members, as you can see, Special Olympics Oregon is already your partner. We seek your support, but we do not come to you with an empty plate. We offer the power of partnerships established over years that are the bedrock of our organization and that continue to fund its statewide programs in all of Oregon's schools in all parts of Oregon. Special Olympics Oregon has never requested, and I want to repeat that, never requested funding before from the state legislature. Although many Special Olympics state chapters, as you heard Margie mention, almost half of them in the country, are supported with state dollars. But we believe our extensive work in our schools today that is helping Oregon, helping the state meet key education requirements, and improving the quality of the education experience for all students warrants our request at this time. Specifically, we are requesting funding of $1 million in this biennium's budget. This crucial funding would expand Special Olympics Oregon's capacity to meet increased demand for unified champion schools, for Oregon team wellness, and for the respect campaign in Oregon K through 12 schools across the state. These funds will contribute up to 42% increase in the number of schools participating in these important programs, all of which benefit students with and without disabilities. And these funds from the state would be matched by, if you think of our annual budget, $7 to $8 million annually. But if you think of us biennially, which is our request before the state, if you think of us in that way, it's over $14 million in a biennium that we are bringing to the game, if you will, and asking for state support for just $1 million to help enhance that program and to expand it. It's really important because we have sponsorships. We have small individuals, and we have major gifts, and we have businesses and foundation grants all coming to help us build that $14 million. As some of you know, or may know, I have a son with autism. That parental experience over many years gives me a very personal perspective on these issues. But again, please know that I would not be here at this time if I did not know how important and impactful Special Olympics Oregon is to all the children and youth of this state, and how critically important this request for support truly is. This is an opportunity to make this public-private partnership work better than ever. So I hope you will join many Oregonians who support the mission of Special Olympics to bring Oregon students the best educational environment that we can bring to them. So thank you for allowing us to testify and bring these issues to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, one thing we do at every Special Olympics competition and event is we give our athletes give an oath, and we always like to swear people in to be honorary athletes. So I'm inviting you to be an honorary athlete today. So raise your right hand and repeat after me, Chair, members of the committee. Let me win.
Let me win.
But if I cannot win.
But if I cannot win.
Let me be brave in the attempt.
Let me be brave in the attempt.
You're all honorary athletes today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, are there any questions of this very esteemed panel? Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you very much for the presentation. I know that Special Olympics has impacted my family's life. My son did a lot of his senior project in high school around the R Letter campaign, did a bike-a-thon with students, had me plunging in the cold waters of Columbia three times. and I have been a fan in the stands at your Newburgh State Games.
Wonderful.
So anybody who ever has has that opportunity, it is incredible to be there for that. So thank you very much for your support of our wonderful athletes.
We're very excited that the Summer Games in Newburgh have succeeded to such a level that we've outgrown, you know, Newburgh, and we're moving them to Corvallis. Mm-hmm. This summer, Oregon State will be hosting the Summer Games. So thousands of athletes being able to stay in the dorms will be a true Olympic village down there. So.
And another wonderful new partnership for us.
Wow, great. Fantastic. Very good. Any other questions?
I would add that the governor has been a very strong supporter. Governor Brown has come to our last two summer games as governor and taken a photograph, I think, with 1,000 selfies with it, with every athlete wanted a selfie with her. And she has included Special Olympics, adding them out in her budget as a placeholder.
I was just going to ask you, I said, what is the avenue that we have for this? I didn't know if there was a bill or whatever, but this is something that's in the governor's budget.
There is something in the governor's budget. So
then I'm sure you'll also have your presentation to the Education Ways and Means. So anyway.
If I might, Madam Chair, we're used to seeing the Special Olympics athletes get medals for competing in skiing and golf and basketball and everything else they compete in, running. This happens to be one of the medals for team wellness. If they've lost weight or gotten in better condition or can do things they couldn't do physically before because they've been working on their wellness, there's also a medal for being healthy and well. And I think that is a very unusual thing. We usually don't get awarded for that. So I think it's wonderful.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
And I can tell you that if you are a partner to an athlete who is going through team wellness, Oregon Team Wellness, and you make a commitment not to drink soda pops, and they make the commitment not to drink soda pop, you better not do it in front of them. because they're the best partner of all. Yes.
And we did meet, Madam Chair, with Representative Smith Warner, who is chair of the Education Ways and Means Subcommittee, and she indicated her support, but would appreciate it if you would all indicate your support to her as well when you see her. So
we will do that. It's a wonderful program that's been around for decades and has done a lot of good for a lot of kids and adults.
And adults.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I will definitely talk to Representative Smith Warner.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for your participation
in a wonderful organization. Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this? Okay. So not seeing that, I will close the informational hearing on the Special Olympics. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2413. Alethea, would you like to introduce a committee measure, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2413 allows students who receive written consent from the district school board for the district in which the school is located to be considered a resident in the district which the student attends the school. It allows students who complete the highest grade offered by a public charter school located in the district to be considered a resident in that particular school. It takes effect on July 1st, 2017. It does remove the requirement of written consent from the district school board for the district in which the school is located for an individual whose residence is not within that district. And that takes effect on July 1st, 2019 for the 2019-2020 school year.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Representative Parrish, testify wherever you would like.
I can just sit up here. That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
So, colleagues, I'm bringing you this bill. House Bill 2413, this has come up over the years. We hear this from families where a child has opted to go to a charter school that is attached to a district. So in my case, for example, my son went to Mitch Charter School in the Tiger Twelton School District. And that school ends at eighth grade. And most of the kids from Mitch would matriculate naturally into the Tiger Twelton School District. However, the handful of kids who were coming from outside the district to Mitch don't have an opportunity to fold right in to the high schools in that community. Our charter schools do keep a percentage of the state school fund for the kids who attend, whether they're from that district or not. And so this is about trying to keep kids together in the communities that they have grown up in. My child actually chose to go back to Westland High School. That's where he wanted to go. But there were kids who wanted to matriculate on and stay in the charter district. And we have some very complicated ways that kids can move on and go into other districts, but not all school districts are participating in open enrollment. Not all of them are willing to let their, you know, accept children from other districts for a variety of reasons. But if we're really talking about doing what's right for the child, then I feel like the ability for a family to make that decision that these are, they found this charter school, they connected to a group of kids, their kids may have been playing sports in this district, and suddenly to take them for their last few years and uproot them and move them back into the home district where they don't have those relationships, they haven't made those connections with people in the district, they haven't been playing sports or participating in other activities. It's another way to extend some choice to kids and keep them moving in the right direction. I would argue if we had enrollment laws like Washington, where kids can just come and go and freely at any time of year, regardless, we wouldn't be having all of these conversations. You know, they've done this in Washington for 20 years. The sky has not fallen. And as kids find the right district that fits their needs. But this is a real small population of kids who we didn't bring up a bunch of ginned up testimony to have folks come and tell you their sob stories because I know we're in a hurry. But there are kids who've been, you know, really displaced. They found the school for whatever other grade made sense to them. We do have a 4th through 8th grade charter, district charter in Westland. And there are kids who come, and they don't always get to come into the Westland High School system, even though that's where they've been connected to kids for the 4 years that they've been there. So this bill really is about making that adjustment, and I would hope we give it consideration. And I know there'll be some folks who come testify in opposition to it, but it is the right thing to do if we're going to be child-centric, child-focused, and making sure that kids stay with the communities that make the most sense to them.
Okay, are there any questions of Representative Parrish? Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious how this works for transportation. So as a charter school, I mean, you were transporting your child. So if that child becomes then a resident of that or accepted into that district, how does that work for transportation?
So what we've done with other, so this bill doesn't address the transportation piece. We can amend it to do that. But what we've done with other enrollment is particularly for like the open enrollment where we said kids can get to kind of the nearest bus stop within the district. And so we have, you know, asked that parents shuttle their kids. I mean, that's part of that choice piece that sometimes, that, you know, if you're making that decision, we said with open enrollment, if you got to the kind of nearest boundary, your child could have that as a stop. So that we're not asking, Westland schools to suddenly go fetch kids from Estacada. Those kids right now, through the charter system, are driving their kids, those families are driving their kids to school.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, no question, but just as a regular sponsor, I want to thank Representative Parrish for bringing that forward. I think it is a very caring thing to do for kids, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. We have signed up to speak on this bill also Morgan Allen of COSA.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA, and I appreciate Representative Parrish's explanation of the issue. I think it's 100% spot on that we have kids attending charter schools, and there's K-5 and K-8 charter schools across the state, and then at the end of that time period, unless that school district has open enrollment or transfers, those schools go back, or those students go back to their home district. And I think the issue with this is, and a couple other things I agree with Representative Parrish on, we have an extremely complicated open enrollment, interdistrict transfer, tuition contract system. And if you've been here since 2000, that's all since 2011. I've lost track of how many bills we've done on open enrollment transfers. I've worked on a lot of those with a lot of the folks in this room. The fundamental thing that all of those pathways have in common, which is open enrollment, interdistrict transfer, contracts, or tuition, is that the resident school district or the school district where the student is interested in going to school has the option of whether or not they want to open their schools to kids outside their district. So in open enrollment and interdistrict transfer, we do not require school districts to enroll students from outside their boundaries. So this bill flips the script a little bit for a small group of students. And I think the challenge there is there may be other students who didn't have an opportunity to attend that charter school that may want to go to that district. And those kids would not have the ability to transfer in unless the school district decided to do open enrollment or decided to do inter-district transfer. So I think, again, this would just add another complicated layer to our transfer system that doesn't address the real problem, which is we have an overly complicated system. In fact, in 2015, We worked with Senator Gelser and Senator Thatcher because there was a K-8 charter school in Sherwood, very similar situation, mm-hmm. students living in Newburgh. And in that case, Sherwood had to decide whether or not they wanted to open up slots for those students to attend at the high school. And my recollection, it was a very difficult decision, and Sherwood eventually decided to open slots because in Senate Bill 709 in 2015, we added language that said districts could give a preference in lotteries or to inter-district transfer slots to kids in these circumstances. And we think that's appropriate. If the school district wants to open their schools to kids that don't live in the community, they should be able to do that. And if we would be supportive of giving preference to those kids if there's limited slots available. But what we would not support is requiring school districts to enroll students that do not live in their boundaries. We think that's fundamentally different than anything that currently exists in open enrollment, inter-district transfer, or charter law. And that's a line that I think we would need to have more discussion about.
Representative Pierce.
So one of the reasons this is a little bit fundamentally different than, say, a regular transfer is that if the child's been attending, say, a K-8, like Mitch, for example, for their entire time, the Tiger Tualatin School District, in that case, has actually accepted and received funds for that child over the duration of that child's education. So it does make it, in my mind, a little bit different in that money's changed hands for this child already. And to the extent that that child received value from the school district in exchange for losing part of their state school fund to be able to attend the charter school is the difference to me, right? Is that for that period of 9 years, you've got a kiddo who has lost a portion of their state school fund, the district has received that money, used it for other things, and then, you know, and benefited from that, and then we're not going to then extend a benefit of the child being able to matriculate into the district that's been holding their state school fund and they didn't see dollars. So to me, that's the fundamental shift here, is that it's not like a kid that just wants to pick up and move but has had no connection at all to that district, and particularly no connection at all to that district in a financial kind of way, which a child who's attending a charter school outside of their district, the home district that has sponsored that charter school, has financially benefited from that child's participating in the school. So that's the difference. I don't disagree that the open enrollment piece isn't complicated. And like I said, you know where I'm at. I like the full Washington state model where this whole thing just goes away and kids can move and come and go as they need to. But in the meantime, this is a population of kiddos that's very small, that the district has received financial benefit from, and then to then say we are not going to keep those kids together seems fundamentally wrong to me. And so therein lies the difference of sort of that notion of flipping it on that side. If the school districts would like to let the children have their entire 100% school fund and they're not district kiddos, I'd be open to that conversation too as a fix, but I don't think that's on the table either.
Okay. That wasn't a question.
It was just a okay. Response to what he testified.
Okay. Because I have a question. So can a school district now just go through, and even if they're not open enrollment, this was the case with the Sherwood Newburgh, where Sherwood didn't have open enrollment, can the district on their own go through and say, we will allow in open enrollment only the children that have been in a charter school that's located in our district or something like that, as opposed
specifically
to
Chair Doherty, what we did in 2015 was for intra-district transfers, we added language that said school districts, if you had attended the charter school, I think it was for 3 or 4 years, so like not if you just attended for a short period, but if you had shown a commitment to attending the charter school, if the school district wanted to open up space and give those kids preference if there was a shortage of spaces or they had to do a lottery, that those kids would get to the front of the line. The issue in Sherwood was their high school, and again, this is a couple years, so I don't remember all the details, but their high school is over capacity. As a matter of fact, I believe they've recently gone out to the voters or about to go out to the voters for a bond, and part of that is a new high school. And so, again, I think Representative Parrish and I agree surprisingly on a lot of the issues related to this and the complexities, but I think the one issue we have disagreement is, and I don't think, and I'd have to look at Washington, I don't think Washington has this either. We've never required districts to enroll students that do not live in their boundaries. And that's what this bill does. And that's a fundamental difference from everything else that that's in open enrollment or inter-district transfers. And I think that merits more discussion. And I think that, you know, we can certainly talk about it. But that's our concern at the moment.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Morgan? Mr. Allen. Mr. Morgan Allen.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Doherty. Two quick questions. Under this bill, if they are legally recognized as residents, are school districts then required to cover transportation costs no matter what?
As Representative Fernandez, as Representative Parrish does, the bill as currently drafted does not get into the specifics about who would be required to do transportation. I suspect that if they become residents, that may be a requirement, but we'd need to talk to council about that. But that could certainly be something that can be part of the discussion.
And my follow-up question to that, which I had, and then I just lost. Give me a second.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Morgan, I would just have to agree with Representative Parrish, and that is that this is a significant relationship that's already been built between the district and these particular students. So I think that elevates it to a different level.
Okay, any other questions? I have one. So in other words, so what this bill is that the enrollment, and I guess this would be for both of you, this would only be open for students who had been in a charter school, not necessarily just all of a sudden telling a district that does not have open enrollment that they have to have open enrollment, period. Mm-hmm. That is the one requirement, is that the student has been at least 3 or 4 or 5 years in a charter school in a district that they would not otherwise qualify for open enrollment.
So, Chair Doherty, the bill doesn't specify how many years a student had to have been in a charter school, just that they are matriculating from that charter school. But this is to get to those kiddos who sort of the legislative fixes before, like the Sherwood fix, doesn't address. This would be a district that doesn't want to open enrollment anybody, and yet you've got a child who's sort of stranded, and because the district has no pathway, or they're not going to accept the child, but they've been involved in that school district.
Okay, so basically, we're taking away the local control that the district has.
Well, you can frame it that way.
I'm serious. I mean, it's one of these things of a district just as something with Sherwood. I mean, it was they did not have space, mm-hmm. They didn't have room. And so, is it something that we are mandating onto the district that they have to do this? Even if they don't want to, by a child that's
yeah, that's
been
what
there.
The bill does. Mm-hmm. If you want to frame it that way, that's exactly
okay.
what it does.
Okay.
And I say that again because the district has accepted money for this child. But and if I moved into Sherwood and Sherwood was over capacity, you know, then they're going to find room for my kid. This is a kid who's been in the district, and I hate to pick on Sherwood because this bill's not really about Sherwood. It's not about any charter school. It's about a child who's been in a district. The district has been taking a portion of their state school funds and then says, no, we're not going to allow you to matriculate and stay with your cohort of kids that you've been with potentially for 8-9 years. That's a problem to me.
Okay, thank you. Did you have another question?
No,
to follow up?
Good.
I do remember my question. I'll start with a comment and then a question. For me, fundamentally, you know, I have several charter schools in my school district, and there are students who are not from the neighborhoods who attend those charter schools. And I would so want those spaces available for a lot of the students that actually live in the neighborhood. And that's just a comment. My second question, if a student is to attend the charter school for just a year and not be in that fifth to sixth grade or eighth to ninth grade, would they still qualify under how the current bill, and this could be either one of you can answer this, would they still qualify to be able to qualify under this policy?
Chair Doherty and Representative Fernandez, my read of the bill is that that's not specified at this time, and it's certainly something to talk about. But again, I think, again, from our perspective, is we agree this is an issue, but we think that the avenues that have already been put into statute address that and retain the local control for the districts.
Any other questions, Representative Solman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on that just to see if I understood that right. So does this bill, I don't know what's the answer, does this bill specify that you're talking about if I had a child that went there fourth grade and the charter school continued on through eighth grade there, but my child wanted to go to the neighboring school, is that what you were just asking? Because I am curious about that then. So would that child be able then to go into the local school district
So this is about matriculating, Rep. Solomon, this is about matriculating into the next grade where there's not a charter school. So if you are finishing up and you finished eighth grade, the next grade's ninth, the charter doesn't go to ninth grade, you would roll into the high school.
So it doesn't have anything to do with?
No, if you are in fourth grade and the charter school goes to eighth grade, you wouldn't hop out and go to fifth grade in the local elementary school. This is about, you've actually completed, you're at the end of that charter school year, you can't, there's nowhere forward for you to go in that district, and now you're going to get kicked back out to your local district, and this is about keeping those kids and letting them roll forward with the rest of their age cohort who they've been going to school with for years.
Okay. Thank you.
Potentially years.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on House Bill 2413? Okay, seeing none, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2413 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2720. Representative McClain.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2720 requires the Oregon Department of Education to conduct a study on virtual public charter schools, requires the study examine the state and federal resources available to virtual public charter schools, and it requires the Oregon Department of Education submit a report, repeals the study January 2nd, 2018, and it requires the report be submitted and presented to the Interim Committee on Education no later than December 15, 2017. It does appropriate $100,000 from the general fund to conduct this study, and it goes into effect upon passage. There is a -3 amendment available on OLIS, which alters the determination of the success of students for students in virtual public charter schools to now consider other factors such as the graduation, test scores, or ranking system of students, and it changes the repeal date from January 2018 to January 2019. Changes the reporting requirements to require the Department of Education submit the report on progress to the Interim Committee by December 15, 2017 and report on those results of the study by September 15, 2018.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Hernandez and Vice Chair Wilson, and thank you, committee, for letting me come today to talk to you about a study on virtual public charter schools. I started this work in 2015, and I actually brought a bill to the 2016 session, and I pulled it because I felt like there needed to be a further conversation with the online virtual schools in the state of Oregon, of which there were 13 at the time, to really see what kind of a study on virtual public charter schools would be effective, not just for legislators to learn more about the school and those types of students who are utilizing the online schools, but also to make sure that it was going to be useful to the schools, it was going to be useful to the Department of Ed, and so we were going to have enough information to make sure that any school in the state of Oregon who has students from the state of Oregon are getting the best possible education that they could have. The actual law in 2009 actually brought about some of the rules and regulations that govern the virtual schools. And in my 2016 bill, I actually had talked about a little bit of the language in the ordinance. I dropped all of that. I decided it was a two-step process, and that the first step was really just gathering more information so that we actually know the differences, the similarities, the challenges, and all of the different types of things that our online virtual schools as well as our online virtual students are actually facing. We had online virtual school practitioners who participated in meetings on April 18th, June 21st, July 27th, or excuse me, it was July 26th, and then also on November 30th. And what we were looking at was to try and make sure that the information that was going to be gathered was really useful. And these were the things that we had agreement on, that we need to talk about access to resources, because for many inventories and for many resources, the online virtual schools didn't seem to feel that there was equal access to some of the support that they might be expecting. Relationship between the host district and the virtual public school. In other words, their funding relationships as far as inventory of what did the virtual public school get offered. They could contract for particular services, for example, maybe for special ed services if they didn't have what they considered to be the type of services that they needed for their students. population served by each community school, the demographics, the credit deficiency, the transfer issues, past educational experience, how the students of the virtual public charter schools differed from students from traditional public schools, identify promising practices in online learning. And also, they asked if we would look at inventories or trends of online learning that was nationwide. Those were some of the items that were important to them, and they are part of this study. The methodology was also important to them. And so we talked about, on the methodology, what would be utilized to actually look at the students at these schools. And some of the things that became apparent was that they really wanted to talk about growth. And I think it's something that we've talked about with all schools as we're reflecting on how are the students doing, and that we don't want to just concentrate on one test that we have one day in the year, or we don't want to concentrate just on graduation rates when we know that there are other elements that we need to know about that student to see how they're doing. So we talked about that, and the amendment that our analyst talked about is on OLIS. If you haven't found it, it is -3. And basically what happened was we had written down as based on growth of the students instead of graduation rates, test scores, or ranking systems of the students. Now, I felt comfortable with that. It was something that the schools felt was important to highlight growth and not the final types of ratings. And I felt comfortable with that because I knew we already do that. We already look at graduation rates. We already look at testing. But when I talked to the Department of Ed, they indicated they thought we should say in addition to. So in addition to was the suggestion. I took it to heart, talked to the schools by email, and got back from them that they didn't like the terms in addition to. So I asked them to come up with some language, and I was very lucky that some of the practitioners at the online schools came up with two different choices. And I asked both our legal staff as well as the Department of Ed if this was appropriate for what they were trying to capture, which is we have to look at graduation rates and the testing. And so the -3 says in that section, based on the growth of the student with the possible consideration of graduation rates, test scores, or ranking systems of the students. Now, to me, that's pretty open-ended. You're going to be talking about growth, you're highlighting growth, you're really focusing on growth, and as you could see, we're looking at the population differences. I listed those five different elements that we would be looking at. So in good faith with the online virtual school folks that I have really appreciated getting to know this summer and over the fall, I have brought forward a simple study bill. It doesn't talk about statute responsibilities. It does not change statute responsibilities. It simply is a study bill that will offer the legislature, the Department of Ed, and the schools an opportunity to know a little bit more about those online schools. Those online schools go from over 4,000 students in one online school down to 92 students in another. Some are very large, very small. Some of them have some blended education opportunities. I was fortunate enough to get to visit at least 5 on-site visits to be able to look at some of their fabulous technology and also some of their really good tactics and techniques. And so this study is really there to support all of us here at the legislature to help give more information for the online schools and for the Department of Ed to support all students in the state of Oregon in every school that they have a choice to go to here in the state. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I also have more details if you want to know more about elements of the study concept.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions of Representative McLean? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McLean, I wanted to ask you about the nature of the informal work group meetings that were held over this period of time. Did the virtual charter school people kind of come along peaceably on this? How was the nature of the relationship as you got together and conducted these meetings?
Well, I think these folks are fabulous, cordial people, and they invited me to their site. The Baker Academy was the first site that we went to, and it was a situation where we were all there trying to figure out what can we do that will be supportive of all of us and the need and the support of the students that we're trying to serve. I have a list. Dr. Daniel Hold of the Baker Webb Academy was the host at one of them. We also had Dr. Sean, and it's I think it's Frenes, from Sylvie's River Charter School. We had Jesse Eisenschmidt from the Sheridan All Prep Academy. We had Sean Gallagher from the Summit Learning Charter. We had Paul Peterson from the Oregon Virtual School. Now, that was just at the first meeting. And we added people by Skype, and we also added people who actually decided to come to the second, third, and fourth meeting. As far as Cordial, at the end of the November 30th meeting, we had agreed on the concept. Four individuals indicated that they would come and speak in favor, and one said they'd stay neutral. Because at this point they weren't sure if it was going to be helpful to them or not. The language that has caused some folks here today to say they're now not so sure is changing the words as based on the growth of students instead of graduation rates, test scores, or ranking systems of the students. And we have changed it to N-3, the section as based on the growth of students with the possible consideration of graduation rates, test scores, or ranking systems for the students. And so that language right now is probably what you're going to hear the dialogue on today, because quite frankly, at the end of the November 30th, we sent out the notes, we sent out the concept, and we got agreement back from folks who, we gave them, I think it was close to 3 weeks, to be able to call back in so that we could get it on off to the drafter.
Can I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to ask what kind of information the Department of Education has on the virtual public, or the virtual charter schools here. Do they have a body of information that they have found through reconnoitering the process? And what kind of database do they have on these schools?
Well, I think we know about databases that we can do better with all schools as far as keeping adequate data on, you know, how students are progressing. And so I don't think there's any more data on the other students from the public schools as there would be for here. But let's just give you some examples, Mr. Wilson. First of all, right now we have a copy of the contract between the actual online virtual school, and we also have with their host school. Now, that contract is different depending on which school and which public school they have their contract with. And so, for example, part of this will be looking at those contracts to see, again, the differences and the similarities between the contracts, what services they're offering and what services the public school is actually picking up through those contracts, so that we can just see what the lay of the land is as far as how these virtual schools actually function. Another example is, of course, there's a big push from the online virtual schools to say, you know, our students come in really credit deficient. And so we want to look at what kind of credit deficiencies those are. We don't necessarily, or have never done any actual analysis, don't have the information to do the analysis, but would after this study, to be able to find out maybe there's a theme here as far as the kind of deficiencies or the amount of deficiencies as far as credits, or when the student chooses to go to an online school, when they choose back to go to graduate from possibly a public school. So it's again to show trends and to make comparisons between these 13 schools and their students so we can understand where they're being successful and what are good practices that are working really well, and then looking at places where there may be some gaps. And that kind of information our Department of Education just does not have.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two unrelated questions, and we kind of just covered the first one. I think that many of us, maybe not all of us, would agree in our conversations with charter school folks that a lot of the students come pretty credit deficient. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some that they show up at the online, not just any charter school, they show up at the online is maybe a last resort to get a diploma. So you can look at sometimes the scores of these schools, not the scores, the graduation rate, which is extremely low and not acceptable. And so you got to look at that and say, what does that really tell us? Does that tell us that we have X percent more graduating than probably would have been in a traditional brick and mortar? Or what kind of students do we have there? So I hope this isn't going to be a question. This is going to be a statement based on the conversation that just took place, that if we're going to gather information and data, that we gather it in a way that we can look at that, and we're not just trying to boil it down to apples and apples, because I think that's incredibly, I don't want to say it's fair or it's unfair. I just don't think that gives the process any integrity as far as what we're really trying to learn. I do have a question.
Can I comment on that? Because I think it's so important. I was in the subcommittee on education today, and I heard Dr. Noor say it is so important that we know where all of our students are and what they need to be successful. Well, I can buy into that general statement, right? But he went further than that. He said whether they can graduate in a shorter amount of time, 3 years or 4 years or even 5 years, we just need to know how to make them successful. I feel like the online virtual schools have not had an opportunity to get some of that support that they possibly could get, because we don't know enough about this comparison of students or deficient credits or what their experience was, their public education experience before they came, because they're not all the same. These students are not all in the same, you know, category or the same type of student or the same needs of students. And so I think it's really important for us to be able to do what you just suggested, is to make sure that we have this study so we have that information on these students. And I would also suggest to you that that was the reason why, if you look at the bill itself, it says concentrate on growth, look at growth, look at the demographics of the student, making sure that we're actually calling out some of the things that we may need more information or understanding of. So I really support what you said there, Representative Springer, and I want you to understand that the language that I see in that bill does just that.
Right. We follow up on that then. What would be some of those supports? You said this would be great so they could call out some of those supports that onlines might need. What could that be, and where could those come from?
Well, I think, again, that one of the things that I heard over the 4 or 5 meetings was that there are some resources that public schools or other types of schools may have an opportunity to access that they do not. Whether it's dollars, whether it's resources, whether it's support from the Department of Ed. But right now we have one person that is dealing with charter schools, not just online virtual schools. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of different things. If we have a better understanding of need and we have a better understanding of difference, where we would have an opportunity to do some of that support.
Thank you. Last question, mm-hmm. The second question. So Section 4... just talks about the funding of this, and it calls for a general fund allocation of $100,000 to fund the study. How would that be spent? How do we envision $100,000 being spent on this?
I worked really closely with the Department of Ed on that, because we wanted to make sure, especially during this very difficult budget year, that the money was enough, but that it was going to be spent well. And I've given another guarantee to the online virtual schools that I've been working with all summer, and that is that once the bill gets an opportunity to see if we can pass it and get on to the budget committee, that we're not done talking to the people that would pursue this type of study. And at this point, there is an indication that there could be a combination of working with the material that we already have in the Department of Ed, so we're not going to try to remake the wheel. Also, you'll see in the virtual public charter school study concept that we made sure that there was language in there and also in the bill that basically said we are working as hard as we can not to have any redundant requests for material or data, but we also are trying to make it as inexpensive on schools as possible. And so to do that, we also need to be very, what I would call, streamlined in our contract and or work that we do right inside of the Department of Ed. So it looks to me like it would there's a possibility of a contract. There's a possibility of a contract and some of the work being done in-house. And there's an opportunity for input if folks are feeling, as we, you know, go through that study, that there's some more needs and we need to have a different combination, or we need a specialist in one area. But again, you know, just like everything else, when you send off a bill and you say you want a study done, we have to keep track of it, right? We don't just say bye, see you later, and let's make sure you've got the report done on time. So it's going to take some interest and some support from me and others, including yourself, that really can make sure that it's the information we need and it's done very effectively and efficiently and that we use every single dollar well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you may have just answered this, but let's label this question as a freshman question.
Okay.
Can you tell me how, like, in a bill such as this, are you able to do it in a, does it have to be an official task force if it's a bill, or can it be a work group? Well, because I think there is a
this particular bill is for a study only. We've already done the work group, which I did with the practitioners and with some of the lobbyists at both the front end and the back end. And so it's not a work group. It's not a task force. It is an actual study where we've called out data that we want them to gather.
Okay.
I told you. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, the next three we have Tonya Gilbert, Allison Galvin, and Sarah Cook. And we've got about 10 minutes or so. Thank you.
Is that Aaron?
Are you signed on? Ed. Tonya, Allison, and...
Aaron.
It looks like Sharon. Sorry.
He goes by Sharon sometimes,
okay,
too.
Sometimes goes by Sharon.
I share lots of things, but not my name.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I wanted to thank you very much for giving us the time to present to you. For the record, my name is Tonya Gemhart. I am the Deputy Principal Operations Manager for Metro East Webb Academy. We are a virtual public charter school in the Gresham Barlow School District. We have been in operation for 8 years, starting in 2009. Our school has grown from 70 students since inception to almost 500 students. We want to thank Representative McLean for giving us an opportunity to collaborate on this bill to better serve our students within the state of Oregon. However, due to some changes in House Bill 2720, the purpose of my testimony is to voice the opposition of these changes in the bill. I can no longer support the bill the way that it's currently written. Although brick-and-mortar public education system serves thousands of students across the state, this traditional system has limited effectiveness of educating our diverse population and cultures. Charter schools and virtual schools exist, such as Metro East Webb Academy, to help meet the needs of these diverse learners. And using metrics that already exist do not accurately portray the need and benefit of such schools. Many of our students transfer in with skills without the skills necessary to be successful working through a high school curriculum. For instance, we had a student, a ninth grader. She tested at a third grade level in math on a national norm standardized assessment when she arrived with us at the beginning of her freshman year. She's gained over 5 grade levels since she's been with us in the last 2 years, but these gains would not be apparent on state standardized testing and other metrics that are used by the state and ODE. Many of our students transfer in with very similar obstacles. Traditionally, these reporting systems don't account for such triumphs, but exist nonetheless. This year alone, we've had 73% of our students transferring in that were behind credits. So to give you an idea, that's 73 students every 100 that we get are not on track to graduate with their four-year cohort. Of those behind, 36% of those students are more than 6 credits behind. So they're more than a year deficient in their graduation. Although the population of students that we serve are also those with mental struggles, bullying, anxiety, and other obstacles, the traditional setting doesn't work for these students as well. So we understand that virtual schools or charter schools are not necessarily a right fit for every student, but neither is the traditional public system. Therefore, it's imperative we have options for the students, and to do so, we need to have accurate account of the progress and successes our students have experienced. The accomplishments of our students cannot be accurately reflected in the current metrics, such as graduation rates, state testing, and student ranking. We do not need additional resources allocated to a project that examines data that's already existing within the ODE in the state of Oregon. We offer a unique opportunity for many students to help students who are traditionally labeled as at risk or of dropping out of high school. We have increased our graduation rate from 14% in our second year to over 50% this last school year, 15-16 school year. We had 125 students earn their diplomas or GED, and 7 of those students graduated with their high school diploma and an associate's degree from Mount Hood Community College. So we have some great, great students in our system. And again, I want to reiterate the fact that 73% of our students have come to us credit deficient. So the fact that we've graduated over 50% of those students last year is a huge feat and something, again, that's not represented in our state data. Lastly, and most importantly, we do have an independent evaluator that comes in and evaluates our virtual school annually. So through Portland State University, much of the data that's proposed in this legislation is already being done at a financial and time cost to our school. We did, in fact, support Representative McLean's bill with the old language, but with the new language, removing that instead of allows the state to focus on some of those points that are already in existence. By having that instead of grad rates, test scores, and ranking, we have developed an evaluation system that is required to focus on those growth points that really tell the story of our schools. So with those changes, it removes the nature of the bill and the nature of that collaborative effort that we put forth in those other sessions previously. Okay. So with that...
Okay, if you could summarize, because we have about six minutes left. So,
anyway, so that's what, in summary, again, based on the material that's written, that we would have to oppose the bill.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, I am Allison Galvin, the Executive Director at Oregon Connections Academy. I would like to also thank Representative McLean for bringing stakeholders together to discuss the role virtual schools play in our state's diverse education system. I do support the idea of equity amongst our public school students, and I support looking at what resources virtual schools currently do not have access to. I believe it is also important to look at the students we serve and to redefine at-risk in education to incorporate mobility and credit deficiency. The sponsor of HB 2720 has stated a number of times the importance of ensuring all public school students have access to all the same opportunities and funding, and I support this effort. However, there are some recent language changes that we just heard about that caused me serious concern with HB 2720, and at this point, I'm not confident this bill can accomplish its original goal. As virtual schools, it is important to note that even without receiving title funds and many other resources available to traditional schools, our K-8 students at Oregon Connections Academy either met or exceeded the state in most areas of state testing, specifically language arts and science. We recognize math is a continual challenge for all of us in this state, and as a former math teacher and instructional coach, this continues to be a priority for myself and Oregon Connections Academy. We are also graded based on our high school achievements on the Smarter Balanced assessments, but mostly our K-12 school is measured on graduation rate, which is the true challenge given our high mobility rates and students that come to us credit deficient. On line 8 of the bill, the proposed amendment aims to include Smarter Balanced assessment scores and graduation rates as an included or potentially included metric, changing the tenor of the bill, originally focusing on growth, to being a bill that includes widely available public data points already in existence. My understanding of this bill was to look at how virtual schools work, the students we serve, and the resources we are able to serve these students with, which is less than our traditional bricks and mortar schools. This change wording on line 8 significantly changes the bill from the original intent to including endpoint data, which is already publicly, available, thus making it unnecessary for a study and not a fiscally responsible way to spend resources during this budget shortfall. Our high school graduation rate is our most publicized single data point. I would like to take this opportunity to share how focusing on growth
If we could summarize
powerful.
And get the testimony, because we really, I've got somebody coming in at 4:20.
At Oregon Connections Academy, we serve nearly 4,100 public school students in Oregon, of which about 2,100 of these students attend our high school. Our 2016 four-year graduation rate is 62%, and our five-year rate is 66%. In addition, those that were with us by October 1st, the full academic year, which is more comparable to our traditional bricks and mortar school, our graduation rate for 2016 was 91%. Our state reported four-year graduation rate has increased over 28%. I just wanted to share, and I'm cutting this way down for you.
Because you can submit your testimony.
Just currently, 44% of our high school students are new to Oregon Connections Academy this year. Of those new students, 58% came to us credit deficient, with 23% of those students being six or more credits deficient, which is a full year behind academically. Also of significance is that 88% of these students came to us after the first day of school. Of those that did not graduate on time in 2016, 95% of those students came to us credit deficient, 95% of them. Yet our graduation, state reported graduation rate was 62%, and our full year academic year graduation rate was 91%. I just want to thank you for getting to know our school more. I want to emphasize that all of the data that is being requested in this study is already data we report to the state or have readily available. When I submit my testimony online, I will also submit a data sheet with our graduation and credit deficiency data so you can all see that we don't need to spend $100,000 when I have it on a document for you already. So thank you, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, and the rest of the committee for taking the time to listen today.
Okay, thank you, Aaron.
I'll try to keep mine.
Yeah, and just with anything that's new testimony.
Exactly. My name is Aaron Cook, and I am the Director of Programs for the Oregon Virtual Academy, but I'm also here as the Vice President for the Oregon Digital Leadership Coalition, which is a coalition of virtual administrators of the different schools. One of the things that I wanted to do was to thank Representative McLean specifically and her staff for working with us very openly and trying to collect information that was important. I'm not going to talk about my school. I don't think that's necessarily relevant. What I will say is that our goal through this almost 11-month process was to ask that we study something that the Department of Education and Oregon doesn't know. They know about graduation rates. They know about test scores. They know about these things. They're actually already collected and could simply be, do an analysis in the back end. What they don't know is the difference between our demographics as it relates to the rest of the state. So initially in working with this, one of the things we talked about was please focus on the things that make us different and focus on essentially the niche that what do Oregon's virtual schools offer the state. What are the pieces that we potentially do that few other avenues are available for districts? We take in several students that would be in graduating in fifth or sixth or possibly seventh year and still obtaining a diploma. We do things differently that brick and mortar schools may have difficulty with and what we asked in this process. And I really do want to thank Representative McLean for being open with us about that, was trying to focus on how we could do that. Unfortunately, the latest change, which happened after all those months' time that we were asked for input, everything else, we got some changes in the last week that essentially I can't support, which add on back essentially everything that the Department of Education already has on us and would focus a $100,000 study into something that really should take probably three or four times that amount of money. The amount of money that was put forward specifically could have looked very well at what we actually do. The demographics have changed. What it's doing now is it will be essentially sidetracked into something else that you can already look at. So I would step forward briefly. I wish I could talk more about that. I know time is an issue, but I would specifically say that this bill, in its current change, I cannot support, and that was one of the things that we had talked about collectively as ODLC, that this latest change is not something that we can support, even though we've worked with the representative for almost a year on crafting this. This latest change from the Oregon Department of Education would not be something we can support because it focuses on what they already know, not on what they don't know.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any quick questions?
Just
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just briefly to Ms. Galvin. Being Executive Director of Oregon Connections Academy, I'm sure you attended all four of those meetings. I just wanted to ask you about the nature of those meetings real quickly.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wilson. Actually, I wasn't invited to the first meeting, which was frustrating for me because we are the largest school in the state, not largest virtual school. We are the largest school in the state. And so, no, we weren't invited. Once I found out about that meeting and how others had attended, I made sure I got invited to the rest of them.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2720 and open up a public hearing on
2382.
Representative Barreto, thank you for being so patient. And if you want to go over some of the summary, because we heard this before, but we're having an amendment.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2382 directs the Oregon Department of Education Future Farmers of America Association to coordinate with the intention of increasing student achievement and improving student attendance for those enrolled in agricultural courses or programs. It allows the Future Farmers of America chapters to apply for a grant in the amount of $25,000 in the first 2 years of completing the assessment. And it appropriates $1,800,000 out of the general fund beginning July 1st, 2017. This bill is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means, and there is a fiscal and revenue impact issued on the bill itself. Fiscal impact is indeterminate, and revenue is revenue light. There is a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment deletes the requirement that the Oregon Department of Education establish an incentive grant program to support public school agricultural and science programs. And it removes the grant startup allocation of $25,000 from the first 2 years of completing the assessment. There is a fiscal light on the -2 amendment due to the indeterminate, due to unspecified funding for ballot measure 98, and there is a revenue statement issued with no impact.
Fine, thank you. Representative Barreto.
Well, thank you, Chair Doherty, and Vice Chair Hernandez and Vice Chair Wilson and committee. Yes, this bill has been heard. Basically, what we did was introduce the -2 amendment, which took out Section 3, and that was the incentive grant program that supported the ag science program, which is already supported. But what we did leave in, though, was all of the information as far as what the program provides, what the teachers and those that work in the program, the extra time that they put in throughout the year in Section 1. And I'll just go through that real briefly, but all the training, the leadership development, tour training, leadership camps, regional leadership, statewide training, officer recruitment, training, coaching, coordinating, a host of minimum 24 state-level competitive events, recognition and awards programs, state national FFA conventions, working the state fair, implementing FFA participation at the state fair, and then general and financial administration, communication, and membership activities throughout the year in these programs. And so right now the reason, or one of the reasons for this bill was that these teachers, these educators that work in these programs don't get compensated for a lot of the time that they put in the extracurricular after school and throughout the summer in all the programs that they take the kids through. And so if you're going to have a great program like this, producing the leadership and the quality of kids that they do and teaching them the hard work and the ethics, you want good teachers that are willing to put in the time, and they should be compensated for that.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Any questions about the members? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this bill just use existing infrastructure and policies that currently exist?
I think it does, and what it is it's not necessarily, it's still an incentive grant that they have to qualify for, so it's not just a carte blanche, they get this if they do this. It's still competitive throughout the state with the different programs and the different school districts, and so it's at least a start. It's a good incentive start for the programs and for those teachers that administer these.
Yes, thank you, please. Madam Co-Chair. And just to be clear and on the record, this isn't making any school district that doesn't currently have this program create it or do anything. This is totally optional with existing infrastructure in place.
Yes, ma'am. Although, you know, in the first part of the bill, in the section one, you do have it enrolls each student registered in grades 9 through 12 for a minimum of one course per school year of an approved agricultural and science technology program. So it does offer that opportunity, you know, for schools that are not have other alternative, I think, CTE programs. It gives them the opportunity to do this.
So it's not a mandate, but it's an opportunity.
I think it's a mandate.
Representative Springer.
So I need to clarify that because I was looking at this language earlier, parsing through that part right there. So this bill, in addition to the wonderful stuff it talks about, and I'm all over FFA.
Yeah.
This is going to make a school district that maybe doesn't have an FFA program. Thank you. Please clean this up.
Yes. Mr. Beyer, would you like to join us at the dais there?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Agricultural Teachers Association. The piece that Representative Barreto was speaking to is not a mandate on schools to enroll kids. What it says is that every school that has an agricultural education program and the students are enrolled in that program would automatically be enrolled in the National FFA program. So it enrolls students who are already in education, agricultural education programs into FFA.
May I restate my question?
Yes, please.
Will this bill make a school district do anything they are not doing now?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, it will not. It will just incentivize schools who want to start FFA or agricultural education programs. It gives them an opportunity to apply for grants to fund those.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wild?
Madam Chair, Roger, I got to say, I read Section 1 also to say that if the school offers an educational program and a student takes a minimum of one course per school year, they're automatically a member of FFA. So if the school doesn't have an FFA program, they're enrolled nationally, but what does that kid do?
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, I guess I'm going to have you point where you've seen that, because the intent of the bill is that if a school has an agricultural education program currently or wants to start one, and that the students who are enrolled in that program would then be enrolled into FFA.
Well, what it says on line 4 of page 2 is that the Department of Education shall coordinate with the Oregon FFA Association to enroll each student registered in grades 9 through 12 in a school agricultural education program for a minimum of one course per school year of an approved agriculture, and if it stopped right there, it'd be easier, science and technology program of study as a member of the National FFA organization. So if a school doesn't have an FFA program, but they've got an approved agricultural, science, or technology program, and a kid enrolls in that for at least one course per school year, it's saying the Department of Education has to make sure that that school district has enrolled that student as a member of FFA. That sounds to me like we're mandating an FFA program in the school, regardless of whether they had one before.
Representative Springer. Because I ran through this, and I think you know why I've been chewing on this language. It's not that I don't love FFA. We've got to quit telling schools what to do. But as I see that is, so you have your school that does not have FFA, but they have some agricultural science class, and they take that class. But there is not an FFA chapter there. So if the kid does that, it simply enrolls their name with FFA Central, and at that point the kid could go to some of the activities because they don't have their own FFA chapter at the school, they could go to FFA activities. Do I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair and Representative Vile, Representative Springer, I believe as Representative Vile described it, it is correct. If the school has an approved academic, educational, agricultural educational program or science technology program, those students would automatically enroll into the FFA association. That is correct. And it doesn't force the school then to start an FFA chapter. It's just that those students are enrolled in FFA and they could join a chapter. I think the North Clackamas School District is a good example. They take students from any of the metro area schools around them and put them into an FFA program, which is the North Clackamas chapter. It isn't a chapter at a specific high school. It's a chapter for the area. So that is, as I see how this would work, it doesn't force the school to start an FFA chapter. It is simply enrolls the students into the FFA program.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Does that satisfy? Make sense?
I don't know if it satisfies, but okay. It satisfies.
So maybe
me
that might be something.
No, I'm happy, and okay. I definitely support it.
Okay.
Well, that's the important part.
Yes, not really.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. Anyone else to testify on House Bill 2382? Okay, thank you very much. With not, we close the public hearing on 2382 and open up a public hearing on
work session.
Oh, excuse me. We're not going to work it today.
Okay.
So
open a public hearing.
Do we need to work it today? We're going to work it today? His bill? We'll wait. We'll wait.
We can vote on it.
Pardon?
Can we vote on it?
Can we vote?
Okay.
On it?
We can open up a work session. Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, if you want to.
We will open up a public work session. We just did a public hearing.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Yes.
We're into the wrong thing. Why don't we open up a work session on House Bill 2382, the FFA bill.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 2nd, 2017.
Okay, Representative Hernandez moved to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 2nd, 2017. Is there any discussion?
I have a question.
Yes.
Process. So, with a fiscal light, does that mean that we're sending this to Ways and Means or we're
yes.
sending it to the floor?
Send it to Ways and Means.
Okay.
There is a subsequent Ways and Means on this. Okay. Is there any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I just want to put on the record that I'm going to vote yes on this bill, but I have some real concerns about the number of bills that we're hearing, all which have a fiscal mm-hmm. impact, regardless of how light they may be. And I am 1,000% supportive of FFA, but there's a whole bunch of other groups I'm also very supportive of, and I'm going to reserve the final vote with respect to how our budget and fiscal issues end up looking.
Yes, and the Ways and Means Committee on Education is the one that actually says yay or nay on the fiscal. Okay, any other discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, if not, the amendments are adopted.
All right. Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 2382 as amended to the floor.
Yeah, that's later.
All right. With the due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means
there.
By prior reference.
Okay. Representative Hernandez moves House Bill 3282 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? That means it goes to Ways and Means.
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing none, Matt, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
How was that?
Excused.
Representative Solman.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Representative Vile.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means. Okay, with that, we close the work session on House Bill
2382. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill, on open hearing on House Bill 2548. Read it, please.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2548 establishes the Future Business Leaders Program within the Oregon Department of Education in order to assist high school students in preparing for careers in business. It establishes a program offering mentoring, training, other resources to students and educators in high schools in the state through partnership with national and local chapters. This bill has a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. There is a fiscal and revenue impact issued. The fiscal impact issue is indeterminate in the because the ramifications of the measure are not fully understood, since the amount available for distributions as grant is unknown, for the grants are unknown. Revenue impact issued is a revenue light. There is a proposed dash one amendment. The amendment adds to the types of high school education curriculum to now include, but not limited to, entrepreneurship, work readiness training, development of qualities for employment. It also allows the Future Business Leaders Program account to now consist of monies otherwise available to the Department of Education. No fiscal impact statement was issued on that amendment. Revenue impact statement was a revenue light for the dash one amendment. There is a proposed dash three amendment which removes the creation of the Future Business Leaders of America program within the Department of Education and removes the proposed components of the program. It requires the Oregon Department of Education to distribute monies to support career and technical student organizations and provide opportunities for students to develop leadership, academic, and career skills. It allows organizations receiving money to be managed by their respective association leadership bodies to coordinate with the Oregon Department of Education. And it amends ballot measure 98 to distribute money to career and technical student organizations, and it goes into effect on the 91st day the session adjourns. The fiscal impact statement is indeterminate, and the revenue impact statement is a revenue light. And there's a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hack.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, State Representative Jody Hack, House District 19. I am back before you relating to House Bill 2548 and to talk about the dash three, which she just went over with you. I'm just here to clarify some of the dash three amendments. What we did was to clarify the language when I first came to meet with you about HB 2548. So what we did is to say that all of the technical student organizations, which I believe is FBLA, DECA, Skills USA, FFA, and all of those folks would qualify for the Measure 98 funds. That's what the bill does. And it just says that they're able to qualify for that funding. Takes out any misgivings, any notion that they could possibly not qualify. At the end of the day, school districts are going to have to put forth a plan to the Department of Ed, and those plans have to be approved by the Department of Ed, so this would have to qualify under that, just like anything else. But all it does is open up the door and give them the opportunity to be able to access those funds. Therefore, the fiscal is undetermined somewhat because we don't know what the impact completely is going to be for Measure 98. Outside of that, there is no fiscal. All we're doing is to say that, yes, they should qualify to be able to receive those funds under Measure 98.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
Does it make any school, thank you, Madam Chair, does it make any school that does not have a program create a program?
No. Thank you. Does not.
Okay. Representative Vile.
Okay. As a former FBLA volunteer, a longtime sponsor of FBLA in the local schools, I'm 100% behind FBLA, but help me understand why you think that fits with the science technology concept that I think most voters were considering when we voted on the last Measure 98.
Measure 98 is career and technical ed. FBLA falls absolutely all over in career and technical. Okay, so when we had everybody come and testify, one of the biggest pieces of FBLA has to do with entrepreneurship, getting kids ready for jobs. If it wouldn't have been for FBLA, I would not have. I mean, I learned interview skills, and if you remember Representative Doherty's, your staffer came and spoke about his experiences. I was a first-time college goer in my family. If it would not have been for FBLA, I don't think I ever would have had the opportunity to go to college. No one in my family had gone to college. and the connections that I made with FBLA, especially living in a rural community, and the connections that I was able to make with business. We had a direct line to businesses in our community because of FBLA. So I can't think, honestly, of a better group that has the impact for the CTE and should be. To be honest, Representative Doherty and I struggled a little bit to let some of these other groups join on to our bill, but we did because we felt it was the right thing to do. But we both felt really strong that FBLA probably leads the charge among these guys for CTE.
Madam Chair, follow
up. Follow up.
Representative Hack, don't get me wrong, I am 1,000% behind FBLA and will remain so regardless. But I want to make sure I understand, are you confident that the future underwater welders of America would get the same cut at Measure 98 money as FBLA would if we pass this bill? Or does this bill kind of, just like the FFA bill, another bill similar, does it put certain groups sort of ahead in the pack when we're passing out Measure 98 money, assuming we ever get some?
Okay, so how Measure 98 is going to work? This is straight from Salome Dorr. This is his understanding. Each school district is going to have to put forth a plan. Okay, and they're going to say, all right, let's say they get the $800. And they have a strong FBLA plan program, and they have a strong welding fabrications department. And they say, we want to put $400 per student up to 100 students that are in our FBLA program toward FBLA. And we have 100 students that are in our fabrications program, and we want to put $400 toward the 100 students in our fabrications program. So long as they can say, these are how we're going to measure our outcomes, these are the things that we're going to do to promote our programs, these are the things we're going to do to improve achievement, all those measurable outcomes, they get their money. So it's up to the school district to decide how they're going to spend those dollars and what they're going to do with them. This merely says we want to make sure that these organizations are at the table and can be players because they should be.
So putting FBLA or FFA or one of these other organizations into the Department of Education as a specially recognized establishing a program doesn't give it priority over some group that doesn't have a program within the Department of Education?
Chair Doherty, Representative Vile, they're already established under the Department of Education. They're already there. That's what the student, the career and technical student organizations are already under the Department of Education. They already exist.
That's what I thought, and so this is confusing me because now we're saying it again as to a particular organization.
Chair Doherty, Representative Vile, they're already under the Department of Education. What this bill does is it says, let them have a shot at the Measure 98 money. That's all it says. Let them be an equal player. Let them have a shot at it. If the school districts want to use these, do it. If they don't, don't. But let them have a fair and equal shot.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Does that answer your question? Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Representative Reardon, did you want to say anything, or...?
I just, Chair Doherty, thank you for acknowledging me. Jeff Reardon, State Representative, District 48. I just came down just because I was a former career technical student organization teacher and one who has advocated for these programs. I thought I might be able to answer questions, but Representative Hack has been a star up here, and I have nothing to add.
Thank you. Okay, so basically this does not mandate that schools do anything. The what you're asking for, at least under the programs, is already under the Department of Ed. Basically what this bill is doing is putting it in the realm of Measure 98 to be able to request Measure 98 funds.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, yes. We're just saying without a doubt let these guys have a shot at those dollars.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on 2548, and we're going to... Pardon? You guys want to work it?
I'm okay to work it.
So we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2548.
I'm feeling productive.
Senator Fernandez.
All right. Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 3rd, 2017.
Okay, Representative Hernandez moves the adoption of dash
to adopt
dash three amendments dated March 3rd, 2017. Is there any discussion? Representative Vile.
Madam Chair, I'm going to be a yes vote on this, again, because of the fact that I feel so strongly about the value of FBLA as well as some of these other programs. However, for the record, once again, I, notwithstanding Representative Hack's very patient attempt to help me understand, I still don't quite understand why we are giving some programs what feels like a different status than other programs. And when it comes to the budgeting process, I have some real reservations about how all this is going to work with these various groups that have come before us. That's all I needed to do is put that on the record. I will be a yes vote. Thank you.
Any other questions? Discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say the more times that we have to talk about CTE and vocational training, just warms my heart. So,
now we just have to find the money for it. Yeah. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, any other objection to the amendments? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 2548 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Representative Fernandez moves House Bill 2548 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there any, discussion? Matt, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative
McClain. Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Excused.
Representative Solman.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Representative Vile.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. The bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Anything else today? Okay. House Committee Means. Anything else today? Okay. House Committee